doing a little bit of a scramble through the woods here.
Martin Nicholson is walking the grounds of Washington Park's Hoyt Arboretum. He's searching, not for a unique tree species or botanical garden, but for a long-lost grave.
That's what I think on the map. There's a pencil mark that says like 375 feet from the spot, and that's the spot I measured from based on the scale of the map. So we just have to walk 375 feet from here, supposedly.
More than a century ago, the Multnomah County Poor Farm operated here in what is now Portland's Washington Park. The farm provided housing and care for thousands of people in need who lived and often died there. Like one resident who was sometimes called Wong Louie. He arrived at Multnomah County's Hillside Farm in 1906. Newspaper records say he had leprosy. County officials isolated him in a small shack away from the main building and other residents.
And I just imagine it was pretty lonely. Yeah, I imagine it was very difficult. And I mean, some of the articles too, it sounds like, you know, he had thought that he may be able to return to China as well.
But Wong Louie died in 1907, just a year after arriving at the poor farm. Newspapers say his shack was burned and his body buried in a pauper's grave at the site.
Everything that we have between the maps and like the descriptions that show up in some of the articles, they all put it in this like general area. Like we were probably within a, you know, 400 foot circle around this area that we feel pretty confident in. So, yeah.
At different times, markers indicated the location, but those are all long gone. Just like most records of Wong Louie and Oregon's county poor farms.
Anyone who could not support themselves, anyone who didn't have a reliable paycheck, anyone who was possibly in a transient labor situation.
If you were sick and needed a doctor, they were going to call one, and they were going to pay for it.
But there's still a stigma attached to having to go to the poor farm. It was the last resort.
And it was what you did to take care of your people who couldn't take care of themselves.
From the newsroom of OPB, I'm Jen Chavez, and this is The Evergreen, a podcast about the place you call home. Today, we are bringing you the story of Oregon's poor farms. They provided food, medical care, even burial services for those without a home.
Other than this kind of community, county support, there really wasn't much of anything. There weren't any federal programs.
And how these county farms compare to the complex systems in place to support people experiencing homelessness today.
There's not this idea of community kind of looking out for vulnerable people like there was in the past.
That was OPB Oregon Experience producer Cami Horton, who produced a documentary on the history of poor farms, and OPB Portland City Government reporter Alex Zielinski, who dug into causes and potential solutions for homelessness today. They're both joining me to talk about the past, present, and future of support for people living in poverty. Cami, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to start off with Wong Louie, one of the residents who lived on the Multnomah County Hillside Poor Farm. What did it feel like to you to walk among the trees and try to find his lost grave while you were filming for Oregon Experience?
You know, it was really personal, and that's why we wanted to go up there and do the filming. We wanted to walk around in the spots where he had been and to try to get a sense of what it might have been like. I became very interested in him because he represented all of these thousands of people that are largely nameless that lived in Oregon's poor farms.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, records about Wong Louie's life and time at the farm are limited. And that also applies to Oregon's poor farms in general. Surprisingly little is known about them today. But a new discovery was made recently.
So this is the scrapbook. It's a recent accession that we got from a fellow that contacted us and said that he had some records from the Hillside Poor Farm.
That was Terry Baxter, archivist at Multnomah County Archives. And Cami, you got to see these new photos while you were filming. Can you describe them for us? What did they show?
before this donation, there had only been about 3 images, and those were of buildings. These images, about 70 of them, which most of them were really clear and nicely done, showed the inside of buildings. They showed residents. They showed someone who looked like a doctor. They showed a cemetery, which was fascinating because there may have been as many as 3 cemeteries up in the area that is now Washington Park in the Oregon Zoo area. But we don't know exactly where those would have been. So in looking at these kinds of images, there are all kinds of new research that can be done and interesting things that can come out of those.
Yeah, that's incredible that there were only 3 photos that existed before. What a cool discovery.
Yes, it really was.
So let's go back to the beginning of this story. Why were Oregon's poor farms created in the first place?
Poor farms were created as kind of an evolution of the British system that had workhouses. And then when white settlers came west, they brought that same idea with them. And so before Oregon was a state, when it was still a territory, the white settlers created a law in 1854 that counties were responsible for taking care of what they called their indigent residents. And there were a variety of ways that they did that. And eventually, that evolved into poor farms that were all over the state. Other than this kind of community county support, there really wasn't much of anything. There weren't any federal programs.
Mm. And I'm curious, during this time, how was it determined who could get help or support from the government?
It really depended on the area, the resources, the time frame. In the earliest days, a community might just come together and decide that their neighbor had had an accident, and so taxes were going to pay for that. But then there were also judges and a commission of people that someone could go before, or it could be petitioned to them that this person might need help. And in many ways, that could just be something like a cash payment or food for their livestock or things like that. But then as communities started to grow and got larger, there became other ways that people could actually end up in a poor farm. And that could be the judge or the commission, as I stated, but that could also be a sheriff, or that could be a doctor, that could be someone that would put forth a petition on behalf of someone else. Or sometimes people would just go to the poor farm and ask for help, and it would be up to the people that were running the poor farm to decide.
Mm. What about who ran these poor farm facilities? Who were the people that were actually taking care of these residents?
So for poor farms that were actually operated and built by counties, it was hired superintendents who ran them. One person I spoke with, Megan Burke from the University of Texas at Rio Grande Valley, had this to say about that.
Those people in charge could make or break the experience. They could be the difference between cleanliness and filth, between good meals and terrible meals, between sometimes physical mistreatment and compassionate care. And so it really did matter. It mattered who you had in charge there, not just for the finances, but also for the care of the residents.
Were these always these large facilities? Like, the way that the system worked varied a little bit, right?
Absolutely. It varied a lot according to where they were located or how large your population was or how much money the county had. So oftentimes, they weren't big institutions like that at all. They were actually small farmers that were being paid in order to have someone in their house that they then cared for.
And what motivated these people to get involved with the system as caretakers?
Ultimately, it was money. They were being paid by the county for the people that they were caring for. Some of them, you know, may have also really wanted to take care of their neighbors. But, you know, it really made a difference to a lot of people to have that extra income. Public historian Marin Aron had this to say.
You could certainly have people who were caring for a number of individuals that was comfortable to them in their household, or you could have people who were looking to make the most amount of money from the county, taking in more people than they could reasonably afford to feed and clothe and shelter.
And, you know, there were a lot of ways that people could end up kind of skimming the system or doing fraud and trying to get away with getting more money from the system as they could. And it's the amount of money that people made really varied. So just as an example, in Jackson County, the caretaker of the poor farm there in the 1890s made $4.50 a week per person. And interestingly, a lot of times it was comparable with how much the prisons were paying per person. So those were kind of the same amounts. And, you know, the residents of these places, they were actually called inmates.
Wow, I would have never thought of that comparison.
It is really interesting. And the term inmate was actually used quite a bit when you were talking about people that were under the county or the state's care. But I think people in society kind of had a negative opinion of a lot of people that did use poor farms, even though they were providing a really important service to the community.
You know, and we've talked about how these people who came to poor farms were often living in poverty. Can you tell us more about what types of folks resided on these farms?
So there might be people that were spending their lives, the end of their lives, at poor farms. But then there were also people that were going there to give birth. Or there were children that had been orphaned. Or there would be someone that maybe had become injured on the job or something like that. So it really depended. But Jan Wright, who's an archivist at the Southern Oregon Historical Society, can tell us more. She's really been studying this.
It was mostly old people and white people, but from the records that we have, there are Chinese, there are blacks, there are young people, a widow with four kids who are there temporarily. They just have nowhere else to go.
Another question that I had, were there any conditions for living on a poor farm? You know, for example, these were farms. Were residents expected to farm in exchange for being able to live there?
You know, that's really kind of the misconception.
At
least in Oregon, that really wasn't the case. It may have been the case in some other parts of the country. But for the most part, you were dealing with people that weren't really able to do the work.
What they found out very quickly was that people are coming to a poor farm as a means of last resort. They're coming because they cannot work and sustain themselves outside of the institutional setting. And if they could work enough to make enough money, they wouldn't be here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. And it's clear that a lot of these people were in a really vulnerable place in their lives when they were in these poor farms. And unfortunately, at this time of vulnerability, there were some reports of abuse or neglect that people dealt with from the caretakers of these facilities. What did your research find about that?
There really were a lot of cases of abuse. And unfortunately, there weren't very many investigations. Sometimes the newspapers would do investigations, but there weren't very many on a county or a statewide level. But there was one in 1907 in Jackson County that did find abuse.
There was usually at least 12 or 13 people in that house, and it's a tiny house. They were not adequately fed, and they reported in the paper, they gave it scathing reports.
And because of those reports, a new county-owned and operated farm was built just within weeks.
It was a two-story building. It had a full basement with a furnace in it. It even had plumbing, which wasn't a standard thing in 1907.
So that was a real upgrade for these residents. They had such a bad time at their old poor farm that they actually decided to move out and live in tents while the new one was being built.
Wow. Okay, well, it's a good thing this investigation happened.
Right.
You know, all of this has me wondering, were these poor farms seen by residents and locals of these communities and local governments more as a way of helping people or potentially just as a way of hiding these people away out of sight?
Right. I think they were probably both. I think that there was really a community effort in most places to try to help people. But there were also many vagrancy laws in many towns around Oregon. And so there was a movement to try to get people off of the streets, away to where they weren't seen. And that definitely was one of the reasons that these kinds of places were built.
We know that for a long time, these facilities were the primary way people in need could get support. Where did things start to change for poor farms?
Well, by the time we get to the 1930s, things are really changing. Populations are growing, and more people are living in poverty. And populations are shifting all over the state. So counties are getting influxes of people that they just can't handle anymore. And then with New Deal legislation, specifically the Social Security Act of 1935, things really start to change.
it shifts the sort of source of who supports the poor and how that process works. It moves a lot of that burden of expense to the states and the federal government for the very first time.
And that New Deal legislation, it really marked the beginning of the end for poor farms and that long legacy of county-funded relief.
Social Security had a very specific clause in the original legislation that anyone who was going to receive Social Security could not live in a public institution. And so by the early 1940s, the late 1930s, a lot of counties are closing the institutional part of the poor farm.
So what happens to poor farms from there? Did they go away or turn into something else?
Most of them went away at that point. But in some counties that were flush with money, they continued to operate, but as nursing homes. And some continued for many years. There was Edgefield out in Troutdale, and then in Jackson County, who actually put money into their poor farm, making it a pretty robust nursing home.
So, Cammie, you spent months researching and reporting on these farms. And as we've been talking about, you've uncovered a lot of information about a history that we don't know very much about still today. Stepping back and looking at their whole history, what do you think was significant about poor farms?
I think there's a couple of things that are they're really interesting to me. And one of those is that before Oregon, when it's even a state, when it was a territory, there was this decision that legally we were responsible for our neighbors, that communities would take care of their neediest, and that that was in place for a very long time. And it was something that was known in communities. So people knew where to go or who to talk to. These things are actually printed up in the paper. You knew who was at the poor farm, and you knew how much was being paid, and you knew who to go to, depending on what your community was. So it was very well known as to where to go, how to ask for help. And for the most part, a lot of people would get at least something. And I think that that's very different than what we see today. At that time, there really was a set way to go about getting help.
Well, Cammie, thank you so much for all your reporting on this and for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Coming up after a short break, OPB reporter Alex Zielinski compares Oregon's poor farms to the system supporting people living in poverty today and helps us explore potential solutions to homelessness. Alex Zielinski, I want to turn to you now. Alex, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So as we've been hearing, these poor farms were advertised in local newspapers at the time. People who needed help knew about them, knew that they could turn to them. How does that compare to now?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question because the reality is that there's really no apples to apples comparison between then and now. It's a lot less straightforward. Most help comes from the federal funding or state funding to fill the gap, like Medicaid and food stamps or unemployment payments if someone loses their job. But there really is no such thing as public housing available for people too poor or too sick to take care of themselves. Instead, the government expects people in those situations to really navigate this messy web of federal services on their own. There's not this idea of community kind of looking out for vulnerable people like there was in the past. And as most of us know, you know, navigating that system of social services, even if you, you know, it's a task that's already so difficult, even if you have a house and if you have a job. And so it's incredibly difficult.
Yeah. And to speak to that, for your recent series about homelessness in Oregon, you did talk to multiple people who previously lived on the streets or in shelters. What did they tell you about their experience trying to get assistance basically in any form from public services?
Yeah. So it's fair to say off the bat that the biggest barrier to solving our state's homeless crisis is the lack of affordable housing. Mm-hmm. But the second biggest issue, I'd say, is really the under-resourced and poorly coordinated network of social services for people experiencing homelessness. Mm-hmm. Like you said, I talked with a number of people who'd spent years living outside, and they all had these similar stories about how bad communication or misinformation from these different public programs that would get them into housing or recovery, how they added months, if not years, to their wait. For example, I spoke with this one woman, Candy Silvis, who became homeless in Hillsboro after leaving an abusive relationship. She applied to a ton of different housing programs and was placed on a number of waiting lists for housing. And she'd spend most of her weekdays just calling her caseworkers to see if there was anything available or any movement on those lists. But they weren't always really there for her.
I had a case manager who I called for 4 months and left messages with that I found out was not employed and never knew. And no one decided to tell me. So
just kind of
I just thought, well, he's obviously ignoring me.
So there's no communication with her that her caseworker had quit. One thing Candy also told me is that she just got used to hearing, you know, the term 3 more weeks from these folks, as in just wait 3 more weeks and then we'll get you into housing. She was told this for like 3 years and over again until she finally got into an apartment. Needless to say, she lost a lot of trust in these systems over that amount of time. This frustration made her own mental health problems like anxiety and addiction that much harder to cope with.
There was days I gave up. That's it. I'm drinking. I don't care. Then I wake up in the morning and be like, oh, no, I care. I don't want to live like this. I think being connected with the agencies that do care for us, they care. Mm-hmm. It's what keeps us going. Like having people that you know care.
So you can tell that she did have some positive experiences with these programs. She found a few really reliable advocates, and those were the people that helped her get into her new apartment this summer. To have a system that is so reliant on the capacity and commitment of individual social workers, people who are historically underpaid and overworked, right. You know, that's a really dicey model to rely on. I think what's often misunderstood by people who've never been homeless is how truly impossible it feels to leave it behind. There's just so much that's required every day to try and move the needle just a little bit in your life. For many, just getting those basic needs met, like finding food, water, a toilet, a place maybe to take a shower, it takes a better part of a day. Then you're trying to get healthcare or check in with housing programs or federal assistance, and maybe your phone is dead or you don't have a computer with Wi-Fi. It's just a lot of things that house people don't have to consider. I spoke with a woman named Lainey Clarkson, who was raised in a middle-class household and never imagined having to live outside, but she lost her housing after losing her income and getting evicted.
I don't know how to do this. And it's hard. It's really hard to, how can you progress? You can't progress without stability. How can you get stability on the streets? It's a conundrum. And especially, being a woman, single, you have to watch everything. All the time. Everybody, all the time.
It's so hard to try to put yourself in her shoes, but the way she explains it, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So obviously, homelessness is a very complicated issue with a lot of history and not necessarily a silver bullet or easy fixes. But part of your series digs into possible solutions for homelessness. What are some potential solutions from the people in charge here that you looked into in your reporting?
Yeah, well, like I mentioned earlier, the biggest solution is housing.
Right.
But currently, state analysts estimate that Oregon's housing supply is short roughly 140,000 homes to meet the demands of its population size. But building new housing that's affordable, that takes time. So most of the solutions I looked at were more short-term fixes, more like triaging the situation than curing it. So right now, there are a number of paths out of homelessness that are working for people. That can look like moving people into an outdoor tiny village, which are, clusters of small enclosed sleeping pods with bathrooms and laundry and community spaces on site. Or it can look like moving people into their own apartments with deeply subsidized rents and on-site services to keep them housed. Shelter beds work for some people. Others do well if they get a few payments to help pay rent if they're facing eviction to keep them from becoming homeless. I think what makes all of this extra challenging is that there's no one-size-fits-all solution for people experiencing homelessness. And you never know what solution or investment will work for what person. I spoke with John Tapania, who's a senior policy analyst at Eco Northwest. I should note here that he is also on OPB's board of directors. Here's how he explained the challenge of not knowing how to predict what solutions might help each person.
in my mind, it's sort of like we've got terrible drought conditions all over our forests. We have limited money to go out and treat the forest. And so where's the lightning going to strike?
So modern day homelessness is still a pretty new concept, which means that there is still a lot of research and data that needs to be collected to measure its solutions. But John told me that based on existing data, permanent supportive housing appears to be the most effective tool to reduce and prevent homelessness. So this idea, permanent supportive housing, it's a concept when people experiencing homelessness get placed into their own apartment, are paired with social workers and other supports that help ensure that that they stay housed. For some people, that looks like someone who can help with job training or if they have a drug addiction treatment center on site. For others, it could just be as simple as having someone to teach them how to make healthy meals, which could be hard for someone who's lived without a kitchen for a long time or a fridge. I spoke to a woman named Eileen Burns, who became homeless a few years ago. Here's how she explained her path to homelessness in an interview I recorded with her on my phone.
I lost my husband after being married for 20 years. And I just didn't care. I gave up. I just said, I don't care about nothing. And put all my stuff into storage and hit the streets. I was getting ready to lose my place anyway, so I just packed up and moved out.
Eileen now lives in a permanent supportive housing complex in North Portland. To her, supportive housing looks like having someone help her get a new ID, which was stolen when she was living outside, help her get her criminal record expunged. She had a charge for skipping a bus fare a couple decades ago. And it's also having someone help her apply to nursing school, which has been a longtime goal of hers. So it's not just giving someone keys to an apartment and saying good luck. It's the keys and then the wraparound support to make sure they can stay on track.
I couldn't tell you enough how comfortable I am here. I don't have to worry about nothing. I'm not scared. I'm not nothing. This is my home.
I mentioned Lainey Clarkson earlier. She was able to move into a tiny pod village in Eugene called Opportunity Village, and that really worked for her. It's given her a lot of the stability that she was looking for.
It's a moment to pause. And this place has gotten me mentally stable, but... And that comes from being physically stable, knowing you have a warm place to sleep at night, knowing that your stuff's safe, knowing that my dog's safe, knowing that I have a kitchen to cook in, knowing I have a shower. These are huge things. And so that then feeds into mental stability because I don't have to worry then about all these different components that you usually do without a place like this.
So after people move into this village that Lainey's at, they're connected with caseworkers who work with tenants to move them into more longer-term housing. And Lainey is now planning on moving out into her own place in a few months, which she never envisioned before.
Oh, great. And it is clear that there are so many different potential moving pieces to this issue. After looking into all of these potential solutions that you did in your reporting, what sticks out to you is what needs to happen next from lawmakers to put some of these solutions into motion?
Yeah, well, I think something that's hard for many of us to realize, especially when we see large homeless camps on the side of the road every day, is that a lot of these solutions are already in motion. But they certainly aren't moving as fast as they could. Let's take a look at Portland, for example. In 2020, voters in the Portland metro region passed a tax measure that put millions of dollars toward funding programs to get people into permanent supportive housing, like the program I mentioned earlier. Those dollars are going out the door now to people who need them, but it's slow. And that's because the money is being distributed through the county, which contracts with nonprofits to spend the money. And here's kind of where the problem lies, because nonprofits that work in this field have a serious staff retention problem because of low wages, poor benefits, and frankly, really hard work. Mm-hmm. We're seeing staff burn out pretty fast at these organizations and leave. And this kind of staff turnover means people living outside might lose contact with a provider that can help them, like with Candy,
right,
or lose promised housing and ultimately remain homeless. The outcomes of that work are pretty slow going because of this contract issue and this nonprofit kind of relationship that they're hoping to mend and restore. And at the state level, you know, Governor Tina Kotek has a statewide goal of producing about 36,000 units of housing a year over the next 10 years. That work has begun with the help of a major legislative funding package that directed cities to create specific plans on how to develop more housing in the near term.
So that work's going on. All of this is to say, though, that, you know, things are happening to address the state's crisis. It's just not easy to see on the micro level, which I think is the hardest part to accept, especially when you see the kind of conditions that some folks are living in right now.
Well, Alex, thank you so much for helping us walk through from the history we've been talking about today to the present day. Thank you so much for your reporting on this.
Thanks for having me.
You can read Alex's reporting on homelessness in Oregon and watch Cami's documentary on poor farms at opb.org. And if you are listening right now, you're a part of our brand new podcast family. Help us grow by leaving a review on your favorite podcast app. Follow us there and, hey, tell your friends. The Evergreen is an OPB production. Mia Estrada produced this episode. Our technical director is Stephen Cray. He engineered this episode. And the rest of our podcast team includes Julie Sabatier and Sage Van Wang. The music in this episode is from Audio Network. If you have a question for us, please reach out. Email us at theevergreen@opb.org. Thank you for listening. I'm Jen Chavez. Catch you later.